To Waseca in 2014, there was no actual species effect on the biomass that resulted in the spring, but the planting method did. And so the drilled and broadcast and incorporated planting methods resulted in greater biomass than just broadcast alone. This was consistent across all species. In Waseca 2015, planting method did not matter. This is all due to environmental conditions varying from year to year, but we did have a difference in species, with the rye generally producing the greatest biomass, followed by red clover, and then the vetch and pennycress. In Lamberton, let me come back here, we had interactions between planting method and cover crop in both site years. So these are kind of the more interesting interactions that I'll expand on a bit more. Again, with increasing soil disturbance, we expect to see increasing biomass. This is in the spring, once the stand is essentially established and compensatory growth may have taken some effect on balancing out the differences that we see here. With pennycress being a very small seeded plant, there were no differences between planting methods. With rye, the interseeded did result in greater biomass. And in this year, we had very little snow cover and pretty cold temperatures, which resulted in the legumes winter killing. I should also mention that Lamberton is a very representative environment of the northern Corn Belt. It's very variable weather. It's a good test environment for a system like this to identify the crops that may or may not be suitable for the system. The following year in Lamberton, we observed a similar benefit with interseeding and with broadcast and incorporate, especially over broadcast. Here in the legumes and the hairy vetch and the red clover, both see these trends in the winter rye. Again, in pennycress, the incorporation and the drilling did not tend to result in any greater biomass in the spring. Soil nitrate nitrogen, this is from Waseca. We saw similar trends at all sites. I chose this to illustrate the point because of we had the greatest winter survivability across these cover crops in this site year. With good winter survivability, we reduced soil nitrate nitrogen with all cover crops the following spring. Note that these differences are not extreme on the scale of, say, fertilizer savings. But across the landscape, when all is taken into account, this could be a significant impact on the nitrate that's getting into the water. Moving on that point a bit farther, and I'm going to spend some time on this graph because there's a lot going on. These are the soil moisture sensors that were installed in the interseeded rye and in the no cover crop check, coming out of the spring and into the growing season. So along the x-axis here we have date, this y-axis is volumetric soil moisture, and then this y-axis is rainfall events, which are represented by the blue bars, and the lines are my soil moisture. You can see as the soil thaws in the spring and we start accumulating growing degree units, illustrated by the shaded region in the back, the rain events coincide quite directly with the spikes in soil moisture, which is expected. But as the rye began to grow and the weather began to warm up, we see this drawdown in soil moisture coming into April and the beginning of May. This is essentially the goal for not only using up extra nitrogen, but using extra water, because water is the means of transport for the nitrogen to escape the landscape in the first place. Here I have when the cover crop was terminated, and then a few rain events followed, and then soybeans were planted, and as I mentioned before, no yield differences were seen in the soybeans following this. In conclusion, the corn and soybean yields were not affected by interseeded cover crops. Cover crop establishment was improved with increased soil disturbance or seed-soil contact, and the cover crops that overwintered consistently resulted in less soil nitrate. I would like to acknowledge the professors that have worked with me on this project, Dr. Scott Wells, Jeff Coulter, and John Baker. as well as the technical support, Eric Ristall and Alex Hard, and the stations, Steve Queering and Tom Hoverstead, for all of their help with this research so far. And with that, I'd like to take any questions.
We have time for a few questions. Last question in the back.
Yes, sir.
Did you have problems with Harry Vetch wanting to come back?
Yes. The question was if we had problems with the Harry Vetch coming back. And the Harry Vetch and the Red Clover were both, in terms of just resistance to the herbicide when we tried to terminate in the spring, it took a couple of applications in some site years to terminate the Vetch. And I would say in some cases the Clover was even more persistent. So that is definitely an area of emphasis with implementing these systems, is to make sure that a good herbicide program is used to terminate the cover crop before going in with the beans. Yes, sir. Go ahead. So the question was whether we've had any residual effect of glyphosate on the cover crops. You mean following our initial weed management in the corn prior to planting? No, we've been using a glyphosate-only system so that there would not be any soil activity to affect the cover crop establishment. And we have other projects in the ground now as well, looking at different planting dates. And with the earlier ones, I would be interested to learn as well if there's any effect on corn yield getting too early. The date that we chose was intended to ensure that we were beyond the critical weed-free period, rather than shooting too early. There are other farmers in southwest Minnesota that are going in at V5 or V6, but for this research, we used V7.
That's all we have time for.
Okay. Thank you very much.